need to understand young children, because I think no matter where we are, what our walk of life is, we always come in contact with young children. And they tend to get on our nerves unless we understand them, unless we understand why they do what they do, because it's so long since we've been young children, it's hard to remember how we felt at that point in our lives. And if they are treated with understanding, they just become more delightful and more fun to be with. And if we enjoy them, then they're going to enjoy life a little more and become much better adjusted to society. Because just by our mere enjoyment of them, they're going to think better of themselves. Anybody who acts irritated and provoked at a child and attacks him as a person destroys something very precious in that child. He needs to think well of himself. Happy children are generally busy, good-natured, and constructive, with sparkly eyes and smiles of pleasure. They are secure in love and ego growth, and they think well of themselves, and they're just happy to be. In the words of one happy, well-adjusted little four-year-old, she said, "I'm just so glad to be me, a child who knows he is a child of God, loved by God through those around him, regardless of his mistakes, has a head start in what we think of as ego strength." Children at all ages need an atmosphere of warmth in which to thrive, the warmth of close, honest human contacts. They need the feeling that adults, teachers, and parents like them, are interested in them, enjoy them, and feel ready to be responsible for them. We notice this particularly here at Holden Village, where we're getting new children in all the time. And if you just take the time to stop and talk to them a little bit, or find out what their name is, so that the next time you see them, you can call them by name, you always get a smile from them, and they always go around with sort of a feeling of buoyancy. Paul Fanning notices every child who comes in, and you can be sure that every child just loves him, and he just reaps a hundredfold that love that he shows every child that comes to the village. I know we had my twin grandchildren here last year, and their mother said they were talking about Paul long into the winter. He made such an impact upon them. And yet he didn't spoil them or, you know, give them, go to the snack bar and buy things for them. He didn't do that. All he did was give them his attention. And that, to a child, is more valuable than anything. And certainly mothers appreciate this. They don't appreciate people who buy sweets for their children up in the snack bar so that they can't eat their dinner. What is it that children really care about? First and foremost, they care about themselves. Their earliest needs are associated with realizing themselves, becoming aware of their own names, feeling their psychological position in the family. These needs constitute the matrix of their earliest interests. Their first comprehensions are deeply personal. Who they are, what they do, what they have, how they get it, where they live, where they go, what they like and what they don't like, what frightens them, and what makes them happy. And they like to talk about these things. We should help them become aware of their feelings and what causes the feelings within them. Not to be ashamed of them, but to be open with them so they know why they're jealous of that new baby. Of course they're jealous. It's absolutely essential, I think, that to be really human, that you feel that jealousy of getting out of the center of things and having to wait while a sibling is being waited on. It's hard to take, but the children need to know that mother and daddy understand why they are jealous. But then I think if we if we could can just explain to them why they are feeling this way, but that we have to be good to the sibling, because if we aren't, he's just going to cry all the more, and he's going to have that much more attention. We might as well appeal to their ego, because that's what they're going to understand. And that soon he'll grow up, and he'll understand things and be more interesting to play with. But I think it is, so often we say, oh, you shouldn't talk like that, or you shouldn't say those things. Children come home and complain about their teacher. Don't ever say that about your teacher again. Instead, we say, well, why did you feel this way? Or you might be able to understand why the child feels this way about the teacher, and talk it through. And he'll come to the conclusion that it really was his fault in the first place, without you pointing to the finger and say, well, you must have done something wrong, you know, or the teacher wouldn't have said this to you. But if we can get on their side and try to empathize with their feelings, pretty soon the whole truth comes out and they realize they were at fault, really. But you don't have to tell them. If discovery is the thing that helps a child learn and keep that learning for future use, if we have to pour it in, they could well forget it. But once they have used something, it's learned. And nothing is really learned until it is used. When we become sensitive to the relation between a child's interest in himself and his slowly maturing interest in other people, we can help him maintain a delicately balanced equation between self-fulfillment and self-extension. He must have self-fulfillment first before he can extend himself. He has to have a bank of self-ego, self-courage, self-love before he can draw on that bank to extend it and have enough left over for someone else. When he's still young, the child needs help toward feeling the confidence of familiarity and power in his own world. We must support his movement toward autonomy. We must allow him to make decisions. Can we structure his environment so it is possible for him to decide what he prefers or what he thinks is best? I had a child who came to a nursery school every Monday morning with his fists clenched, and he was ready to flay out at anybody who came in his way. He was so full of hostility that had built up all weekend. Upon interviewing his parents then, or discussing him with his parents one afternoon, I tried to find out why this hostility had been building up. And I found out that they had a new house, the lawn was freshly seeded, they had new carpeting and new furniture, and it was easy to see that the parents took a great deal of pride in their possessions. And a little boy, 4 years old, could really mess things up. So I can imagine how he felt stymied every turn with this restrictive environment, because children need space, and they need freedom to be themselves, or they're going to build up hostilities. And the father said, but Mark's the only one we've got. We've got to do a good job with him. Every time he leaves for school, I tell him, Mark, now you be a good boy. And I said, do me a favor. From now on, when he goes to school, say, Mark, have a good day, or have fun today. Put a positive emphasis upon the kind of day he's going to have. But you can just see Mark, be a good boy today, those fists just clench up like that. And time and again, Mark would come to school and say, my mother says I can't get these pants dirty. Or I've got new shoes today, now I've got to be careful of them. So he was really hemmed in from all sides. No wonder he was ready to strike out. And I said, does he get to make any decisions? 4-year-old making decisions? No, we don't. I said, what kind of decisions would you suggest that he make? And I said, well, does he get to pick out the clothes that he wears to school? No, I lay them out every night. And I said, well, just have his school clothes in one section of the closet and in the special drawer so he knows what his school clothes are. Then let him pick what he wants to wear. Who cares whether his socks match his shirt or not? But the very fact that he has decided will help him build his self-respect and self-ego so that he will feel friendly toward his world. Well, these parents wanted to do a good job, and they apparently trusted my judgment because they started trying to do it in this way to help Mark be able to make a few decisions, exercise some autonomy. And another thing, I asked the father, do you ever play with Mark? Well, I let him work with me down in the shop, but you know, we've got this new house and I'm building cupboards and I'm doing all these things. I really don't have time to play with Mark. I said, you better just take time, because it looks to me like you're closing this channel of communication between you and Mark pretty fast. And if you don't keep that channel open when he's a preschooler, don't ever try to open that channel when he becomes a teenager. You make friends with Mark. Let him know you respect him, that you like him, and praise him when he does little things that are praiseable. And just forget about all the negative things that you can find wrong with Mark. There are no perfect parents, and there are no perfect children. And the minute a parent tries to be a perfect one, they're going to goof up the job. Good. They're just too hard to live with. It's just no fun to live with a perfectionist parent. We must respect a child's preferences. Welcome his exploration by providing rich experiences as a base for spontaneous and genuine knowing. And extend his cognitive resources with first-hand contacts that nourish discovery, perception, concepts, and opinions. His learning must be his own, accomplished through the intrinsically child ways of doing, exploring, and experimenting. We must become his support and guide, the person who helps him clarify his confusion, introduce him to experiences that feed his interests, and provide his next steps. We must become his ally and his friend. He must be helped to feel first that he belongs in the world, and second, that the world belongs to him, that it is his world, and that it is utterly appropriate that he shall approach it in a spirit of constant expectation and interest in making it over. Total growth depends on the processes of choosing. To solve problems, the child needs opportunity to find and offer substitutes, to care for himself and others. He needs opportunity to sort and fend off excessive demands. To contribute support, he needs opportunities spontaneously to ask for help. Young children do not learn in a straight line on schedule. In their drive for autonomy, they attack the grown-up systems of values without knowing it. They trigger feelings and situations the adult may never have had to cope with before. They expect parents and teachers to help them find ways of making an impact on the world legitimately, in an acceptable way. Mary Jane came to me with her mother the first when she enrolled, and her mother just made one statement: it's either you or a psychiatrist. And I said, now, why do you say that? Well, she said, her brother's under the care of the psychiatrist, and she's having tantrums every day, some of them lasting 2 hours. And I said, what sets off these tantrums? Oh, just little things. She said, I give her a green spoon instead of a pink spoon, and she has a 2-hour tantrum. So why isn't she setting the table? Now, that hadn't occurred to her mother. She was waiting on this child hand and foot, and the child had no chance to discover her own autonomy. So, and I found out that Mary Jane had an extremely strong leadership drive. She was my champion cleaner-upper and setter-outer and fixer. If she was needed, she was so happy to be able to find a way of expressing her way of doing things. And at home, her mother was treating her like a baby, that she just wasn't capable. And it was frustrating Mary Jane, and she knew no legitimate way of expressing herself except to have tantrums. When the mother finally realized what she needed to be doing at home was to be giving her jobs, allowing her to make decisions, talking to her and asking her about her opinions, and making her feel that she was a real person, these tantrums started to subside. By the end of the year, she wasn't even biting her fingernails or sucking her thumb. She had gotten rid of all her nervous habits because she was having a legitimate outlet for these terrific drives she had. And at the end of the year, when her mother took her to Roundup, kindergarten Roundup, they're supposed to be registering for kindergarten for the next fall, she said, "Mary Jane said, now mother, you're not registering. I'm the one that's registering. Why don't you just give me the 75 cents for the insurance and I'll do it." So she said, I stood over in the corner, and there she, Mary Jane, was in line, the only kid without a mother. But she was just feeling her autonomy 100%. And when she got up there, she knew all the answers, what her dad did, and what their address was, their telephone number. She had the 75 cents for insurance. And she said, you know, it's fun to watch Mary Jane in the backyard now. She has so much confidence in herself. She's organizing games. She's doing all these things that she was just dying to do before. But nobody would admit that Mary Jane, who was only four, was old enough to think for herself. But thank goodness she had a mother who was willing to try it this way. And I'm just assuming she won't have to ever be under the care of a psychiatrist. The growing child is nothing fixed. His feeling of belonging must be reestablished as he grows from the status of babyhood in confines of home and family to the status of adolescent. Along the whole path of his growth, he is an active system of feelings, sensitivities, and conflicts. He has a family. He belongs to a family. He has friends and enemies. He is a boy or a girl. He's short or tall, fat or thin, fast or slow, pretty or plain-faced, klutzy or graceful. He has wishes and impulses that cannot be fulfilled. He is frightened of himself. He is proud of himself. He is ashamed. He is lonely or gregarious. He wins, he loses, he laughs, and he cries. For all his small size and tenuous understandings, the young child is remarkably resilient under fire. With a caring teacher or a parent, this resiliency is augmented. When basic love is communicated to the child, he seems to go unscathed by the mistakes of those who love him. Part of this resiliency likely lies in his powerful, quite unacademic push to grow. This force that directs growth is not easily deviated or disrupted. Again and again, the young child is found handling minor, even moderately severe or conflicting stress unusually well. Unless the abuse is massive, intense, prolonged, and generalized, his incredible toughness seems to be nature's way of assuring the survival of the species. And Mike was one of these boys who had to have resiliency because he really had undergone abuse, massive abuse. His parents left him and his three siblings. He was the youngest. One day my telephone rang and it was a mother who said they were moving. So I thought, I can call the next mother on the list and inform her we've got a place for her child. But before I had a chance to even look up who the next mother was, the telephone rang again. And it was an agent from the Catholic Welfare Agency. And she said, do you take emotionally disturbed children in your nursery school? And I said, yes, we certainly are willing to try. And if we can do the child some good, and the child doesn't completely disrupt the activities of the other children, we're happy to take him. Well, then she told me the story of Mike and how he was with a foster home under the care of a psychiatrist. And they were waiting, his name was on the waiting list for a home in Peoria for children like him. And I was full of fear and trepidation when the morning Mike was to arrive as a social worker. And I thought, oh boy, I wonder if I can handle this. And I'd had hyperkinetic children, but never any that I would call emotionally disturbed. Well, Mike walked in, and he was the most beautiful little boy. He had huge brown eyes, and the first thing that came to my mind, I said, what beautiful big brown eyes. Well, I didn't know what an impact that positive statement was going to have on him until later on, when we were ready for rest period, the children would go upstairs and lie on their mats and listen to a tape recorded story. We avoided reading stories out of a book to them because they always wanted to see the pictures. But if there was a tape, well, then they usually stayed flat. But I asked the student teacher, one of the student teachers who was going up there with the children, if she would just sit on the floor and put Mike's head on her lap and stroke him, try to keep him calm, and try to help him feel the love and compassion we had for him. But if he got too restless, to not hesitate to let him come downstairs and be with me. And of course, little feet down the stairs. And I opened the door, and he looked at me, and he, before I had a chance to say a word, he said, but Mrs. Edmund, I really do have beautiful eyes, haven't I? One thing he could grab onto that was really positive. And so from then on, the thing I realized we must do is build Mike up. Not make him feel badly because he couldn't sit through a story. The children had been there long enough, so they were well acclimated. And I had prepared them for Mike. I told them this was a boy that needed all our love, and that we needed to help him in any way we could, that I was going to let him do things that were not within the boundaries that we had set for them, because he needed this special attention. I had told them all this before he came. And of course, you never tell a preschool group that you need them, but what they just come through 150%. And they did give him love. And when I would always have him sit by me as I read the stories and as I talked to the children, as we had our together time, that sort of thing, I tried to keep Mike close. So then I could sense when he was just at his limits. And then one of the teachers would take him out to the kitchen and fill the sink with nice, warm, sudsy water that he could play in and throw things in. And he'd play in this warm water until he became calm, then he'd dry his hands, come back and sit by me again. But he just had to have these moments when he could be excused and get a hold of himself. And he, of course, he was under, they said he was under tranquilizers, but I don't think it was tranquilizers. Doctors don't give hyperkinetic children tranquilizers anymore. They give them, what do they call them? Rosemary. but
yeah, the other, the opposite.
To activate their brain so that they become more alert. And as they're, and it seems that there's something about the more the brain has to do, the more active and efficient the brain is, the less the physical body is required to do. It sort of takes over. I'm not a psychiatrist or even a neurologist. I don't know the principles. But anyway, instead of tranquilizers, this is what they usually give people.
Is it Ritalin or is that a tranquilizer?
Ritalin is one of them they use. What do you call them?
Ketamine's your
state.
Energy. Yeah, stimulants. This is the word I'm trying, yeah.
Well, that specialist explained it to me that there's something missing in the child's brain, which we have, that helps us to be able to cope with all the stimuli coming in.
Yeah.
But this doesn't. They have to react to everything that comes. You know, you can be hungry and ignore it. And somebody can be talking, a whole group of people, you can ignore that if you're talking to somebody.
Yeah.
But they have to react to everything. So the Ritalin or Leonard was on Benadryl helps them to be able to stimulate
take
this
care
chemical
of
or whatever it is. This is what Leonard Smith and Portland.
Yeah.
This is his findings. It helps them to
well,
not react to everything.
We just have to understand that the children are the way they are, and there's a reason for them being that way. And we've got to try to understand them. And when we do understand them, we can tolerate them so much better. So Mike did adjust. I wouldn't know whether he was completely well, probably not, because he'll go in and out, back and forth, I imagine. But at least the nursery school helped him to the point where when my husband came up to help the children with their identify their rocks, he couldn't tell who Mike was. He blended in very nicely with the group and seemed to enjoy the activity. I think that's what the psychiatrist was hoping, that he would get busy with, you know, worthwhile things so that he could forget his own troubles, bless his heart. Sometimes a child's resiliency can be fostered by helping him to be aware of several alternatives. Many choices will be strictly personal. They may be out of friendships, or they may depend upon free time, a particular skill, a momentary want, or a long-term goal. Some choices will be regressive, going back to familiar ways. I had one little girl whose cousin came to visit her with her mother through Christmas, and her cousin was a baby. So, when she came back after Christmas, she was talking baby talk, and she couldn't do anything. She couldn't walk very well. And I talked to her mother. I knew something was setting this off. What she really wanted me to do was push her around in a baby buggy, I think. But she was so envying this baby. And you can imagine what it does to children who have brothers or sisters, baby brothers or sisters they can't get rid of. Fortunately, this cousin moved away then after Christmas. But this hung on. Her mother said she wanted the bottle, and she just reverted back completely to babyhood. But these are things that happen. They regress from time to time. And hopefully we'll be tolerant of occasional regression and watchfully await his signal to move ahead. And we want to help them as they grow to be able to delay gratification. We have an ice cream man that comes by down our street, and a neighbor was telling me about, I said, how do you get the children to leave you alone when the ice cream man comes down the street? Well, she said, we've gone through it. And she said, I told John that I gave him some alternatives. He could buy an ice cream bar now and eat it now. Or he could buy an ice cream bar and put it in the refrigerator or freezer and leave it and have it for dessert. Or he could have, instead of that, he could have a piece of chocolate cake, which was his favorite dessert at supper time. But he had to choose between the ice cream bar and the chocolate cake. If he took the ice cream bar now and ate it, he wouldn't get the chocolate cake. So the first time, of course, he just decided immediate gratification was all he could think of, because he figured somebody would be soft-hearted to supper time and give him a piece of cake. But it didn't work. Thank goodness the mother was strong. It wasn't easy. And it wasn't easy for the rest of the family not to share. But she laid down the rules, and they all knew what it was. And so the next time, I suppose it depended on what the dessert was going to be, but at least he waited for dessert time for his gratification. He was learning that delayed gratification is worthwhile. And another illustration here, Jean Swire was telling me about, she saw a little boy in the grocery store, and And he came with a sack of candy to the basket. You know, they like to fill up the basket with goodies. And his mother said, just a minute now, what does the price say on that? And he said, 29 cents, 39 cents, something like that. And she said, 29 cents, that's 3 dimes. So that'll be 3 weeks' allowance. Now, is that worth it? No, he didn't say anything, but he just went back and put the candy back. But at least he was allowed to make the decision. And mothers have to be tough, and daddies too, when it comes to these things. If they're going to find out that some gratifications need to be delayed, if they're going to build up this part of their character, we've got to prepare the environment at times where they can exercise it and realize that this is the best way. Learning begins at birth, but for the infant, it is certainly largely his biological search for balance. In a natural, relatively simple environment beyond babyhood, life is not so protected. The 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old can be consumed by the energy it takes to cope with countless conflicts in his environment while he tries to master speech, work out social relationships, establish sensory motor skills simultaneously. It's a tremendous amount that a child this age has to cope with and to learn. Then, if ever, he needs a sensitive adult to help him pace his energies. When the child feels at ease with and fundamentally valued for himself as a child of God, he moves spontaneously toward difficulty and into new situations. It is as if he were responding to the adult's belief in his capacity and conviction that he will perform differently when it's possible to do so. Sometimes that support is evidenced by offering aid, by standing by, or simply accepting the child as he is. Sometimes we show our support by issuing an invitation to a new situation. I know Matt just did not want to paint. He was in the afternoon class. I was going to substitute in the afternoon and asked Mrs. Burke if there was anything that she wanted me to specifically do when I talked for her that afternoon. And she said, no, just get Matt to paint. If you get Matt to paint, your afternoon will be worthwhile. Well, this was almost Thanksgiving, and Matt still hadn't gone to the easel. It was, you know, he had to save face now. He refused to go to the easel to begin with, and now to go to the easel. Well, I don't know. He wasn't sure he wanted to admit that he had made a wrong decision. So that afternoon, I decided I wasn't going to ask Matt whether he wanted to paint or not. I would, I'd just say, well, now this group will go into the kitchen, which it was our art room. And we'll have, we're going to learn a song, and then we're going to paint. He says, I'm not going to paint. Well, the children by that time were on their way, and I just picked Matt up and caressed him, just loved him all the way to the art room. And I said, he said, I'm not going to paint. I said, I'm not going to paint either. We'll just watch. And so, we sang the song as the great big turkey out on Grandpa's farm, and as we sang it, we made big circles in the air like we were pretending to paint a big turkey, a big circle for his body and a small circle for his head and big broad strokes for the arm. We did this as we sang, and then I had paint ready for the children to help themselves and go to their easels, and of course they all painted turkeys. I believe we should prepare the children for art without telling them they have to do, you know, paint a certain thing. Tell them a story that might put images in their mind. We used to love to invite an imaginary animal in and play with it. Or if it's a big dog, we'd give it a shampoo. And this one time we were shampooing the dog, the imaginary dog, and talking about its great big feet and its floppy ears and its big long tail, and we were very careful not to get soap in his eyes, of course. And then when he got him all soaked, we rinsed him. And then one little boy said, "Stand back, he's going to shake." And then when we got through drying him with towels the best we could, we just tied him outside on the porch in the sunshine so he'd dry the rest of the time. And later on, one of the little girls came to me and said, "Tomorrow, can we invite a snake?" I think she was secretly very afraid of snakes, but she thought if we invited an imaginary one, she could cope with that. Well, anyway, back to the turkeys. Well, one by one, the children finished painting their turkeys, and they went on to the housekeeping corner to do other things until it was to finish that area of activity. And I said to Matt, "Well, let's take a look at these birds and see what they look like." And we decided they look pretty good. I said, "You know, it looks like fun to me. I think I'll try it." So I got myself an easel and started to sing the Great Big Turkey on the Random Horse Farm. He just sat there and watched me with great big eyes. And finally, I got finished painting my turkey, and I said, "I think I'll give him a red eye." So I got some other paint and dabbed the eye. And of course, I really didn't know from one minute to the other how I was going to get Matt to paint, but the Lord was with me. The red paint ran a little bit, and I said, "Oh dear," I said, "here that turkey's crying already. Do you suppose some naughty old turkey came up and pecked him?" He said, "Could be." I said, "Would you like to paint that naughty turkey?" "Yeah." And Matt painted the most beautiful turkey of all. And he was so pleased with himself. His mother was a little late in picking him up. And before he left, he just came up to me. Now here, I was a substitute teacher. He just came up to me and gave me the biggest hug, just like saying, "Thanks for getting me through this barrier. I always knew I wanted to paint, but, you know, I had to save face. I'd said no once, and I wasn't going to give up, you know." And Mrs. Burke said that from that time on, Matt was one of her champion painters. But here was a time when he needed support in a new experience. And he wasn't about to be forced. This just builds the wall bigger and stronger. It had to be his decision. And he had to know that I was on his side, and that I wasn't going to make him do something that he really didn't feel he ought to do. The young child is incredibly efficient and adaptive in his learning, endlessly experimenting. He is not engaged in random behavior, but in a purposeful and integrating push ahead. He can be remarkably single-minded about polishing a chosen activity to perfection before going on to the next one. I know Ian had to tie, came one morning, and his compulsion that day was to learn to lace and tie his shoes. And he just didn't seem to be interested in anything else. So he had the little girls helping him, and some of the student teachers would walk by and give him assist once in a while, but he just wouldn't leave that job. I don't know what had happened at home or why he decided today was the day he was going to tie a shoe, but he did. And the psychologists call this strategy that consolidates learning. I just call it a learning tick. Something you just got to do it over and over and over again, and it's a compulsion. But we need to allow them to have these learning ticks, because it's an insatiable drive to learn something, and we need to respect that. Just like curiosity, we need to respect these drives that encourage learning. And it occurs when children are involved naturally in their own living and assured of free-flowing situations, protected from premature teaching. Protected by responsible adults who know how to stand by and who can time their instructions to the child's purposeful and integrating thrusts ahead. We need to know when the child is ready, because when the child is ready, he learns with joy. If we try to force him to read before he's ready, we can establish a mental block that he just can't get rid of, even when he gets old enough and mature enough when reading should come easy. We can so ruin it for him by pushing him. We need to stand back. We need to listen. We need to watch. And he will give us a signal when he's ready. Exultant in his newfound powers, the young child sometimes pushes too far. A block building topples. A puppet can't think of anything more to say. Friends leave when his leadership turns to bossiness. It's at such times that the adult role is crucial. If the child receives face-saving help, he can likely move toward the thoughtful reasoning out of the next steps. On the other hand, if he is scolded and punished, his vulnerability takes over. Panic may ensue, and he loses ground, regressing to earlier behavior, withdrawing from the adult help entirely. I've always been impressed by the child's natural drive to learn. Todd had been in nursery school not more than 15 minutes. The mothers hadn't even left yet. It's the first day of nursery school. And he looked up at me and he said, "Mrs. Edmund, just how soon are we going to start learning something?" Children love to learn. They love to learn when they're ready to learn. For the young child, sensory exploration of a variety of materials and familiar experiences is essential to the development of accurate concepts which will be revealed in his behavior. Playing with blocks is more than just building. It's building concepts, and we'll talk about that tomorrow when we talk about Piaget's theories for intellectual development. How simple play, playing with sand and measuring cups, playing in water with floating things, playing with magnets, building blocks, playing dolls, all of these have, if we watch carefully, built-in concept learning. So play isn't goofing off. Play is working for the child. And I think sometimes instead of calling that first 30 minutes or an hour, or 30 minutes in Sunday school, instead of calling that free play, we should call it free work, because they're accomplishing something. And if you're not, now I won't be having the spiritual, yes I will. We'll be talking about this when we talk about the child's spiritual development. But that first half hour with preschool children, where they can seek out their own activities, talk to their friends, a time when teachers can stand by and just observe, is the most precious time on Sunday morning. It's more important than the story. It's more important than singing or anything else. He's practicing life. Or self-worth and well-being are maintained by putting his assets to use. We must emphasize his fortes, build up his self-confidence in the areas where he can shine. He will build up these assets until he has a bank of courage to try something more challenging and even risk the chance of failure. This won't be so devastating because of his balance of courage. You've probably heard, and this I repeat, a misbehaving child is a discouraged child. For this important business of growing up as a confident human being, he must be secure in the love of those around him. Secure as a child of God, knowing his love, he is loved regardless of his behavior or his accomplishments. He's not loved because he gets straight A's. He's not loved just because he's better than the neighbor's child, because he learned to read when he was 3 or 4. This isn't what we base our love on. We base our love on he is himself, and we love him for himself. One of the professors at CLC makes such an impact upon me when he was talking to a group of AAUW mothers who meet at my house once a month, telling, he's a specialist in movement education. His daughter is retarded, and at the age of 8, she still can't tie her shoes. But he said, what makes the difference? She's an adorable child, and we love her. When she does accomplish something, we all rejoice, including her brothers and sisters. And she is our delight. We love her because of herself. Along with love, the child needs space, time, opportunity, freedom, sympathy, appropriate experience, and rich expression in order to establish an active, creative, effective relation to life. And here I have a list of things. I hope I have them all. No, I don't have them all. I do in brief. A list of things which ingredients that usually go into the making of the likable, interesting, satisfactory personality. And of course we want this for all of our children. Courage and self-reliance. Sympathy and responsiveness toward other people. This is what we look for. Vitality and good humor. Adaptability. Intellectual aliveness. Personal integrity. And we can do much to foster these ingredients in our home. And I like that good humor, because so often a joke and or a light attitude about a mistake can change the whole atmosphere in a home. Being able to say, okay, you goof, and so what? We goof too. And I think it behooves parents to point out their goofs to their children and say, boy, I really made a boo-boo today, and then go on and explain what you did. Because only by confession are we forgiven. And how are children going to learn how to confess? And how are they going to learn what grace is unless they experience it in their own home? Because they know when mother and daddy admit their mistakes, that they do it because they know and they are assured of forgiveness. And they're going to catch this. That's the only way they're going to understand God's forgiveness, is to feel it through the people around them. It's only through people that we feel God's love. So it behooves us to furnish this love in abundance, not only to our children, but to all children. And I think it's so important that in our churches, we really pay attention to children, that we really get acquainted with the children that belong to other families, so that we can make it a happy time on Sunday morning. So the church is a pleasant place to go. If we do nothing those early preschool years but help a child feel good about going to church, we've done a good job. That's why I say that those first 30 minutes to me are the most important minutes of the hour of Sunday school for a preschooler. It used to be that we thought we had to cram things down their throat. We only have an hour. We got to tell them Bible story every Sunday morning. And we've got to sing all these songs, and we've got to learn a new game, and we've got to do this, and we've got to do that. You don't have to do anything but help that child feel God's love. If you do that, then you've done a good job. Now, I know there are going to be questions and disagreements here. Let's talk about them. I'm a great authority, and I'll tell people who read a book, don't take it hook, line, and sinker, because read them all. Take what's useful to you, what suits you. Use the things that you can use easily. Gannat is great. He'll give you lots of good ideas of how to handle everyday problems. But there are some things you just couldn't do. I mean, it just doesn't suit you to do it that way. And you know the children would think you were a phony if you tried it. But, and same way with Dreikers. Dreikers is one of the great behavior modificationists. And same way with him. You don't take him hook, line, and sinker, because there are things there that you you wouldn't be able to do and be true to yourself. They would be good for somebody else to use. I welcome you to look at these things. The file boxes, by the way, are things that I have had published, and they are ideas for working with children, art and science and literature and movement education, math. They're just experience cards. They don't need they're experiences for children from say 3 through 8. The activities on there require no reading or writing skills, so that's why they're appropriate for preschool and nursery school.
I have a question.
Yes.
That I'm running into right now with my own children who are 3.5 and 5.5. And I've been asked this from other parents as a teacher, and now it's kind of reversed roles, and I really don't know quite what to do about it. They are so much better when they are with somebody else, like for instance at a meeting that we have or whatever, or with my husband by himself. For instance, last night I was singing the choir and they were at church. They got on just beautifully, no problems at all. When I am there, they're just terrible.
Well, children really do get too much of mother a lot of times, because mother is the authority figure who's always bossing them and telling them what to do. And daddy usually is with them a short enough time so he can have fun with them and enjoy them. I'll never forget what a grandmother said to me. Well, she was sort of our counselor in our University of Women's Mother Group when I had young children in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was talking about how children really need boundaries, and of course it's always up to mother because daddy's working. And she said, I try to get my husband to be the authority figure and to punish them, you know, and to secure these boundaries, you know, share a little bit. And he says, but I want my children to love me. And she says, I came back at him with, well, I want my children to love me too. But I think it's more important that other people love them. And I think sometimes they just get too much of mother. I really think that is probably the answer. Now, what you can do about it, I think we often come across to our children like talking machines. And it's natural. One child came... there was a psychiatrist, or a school psychologist rather, in the Oklahoma City schools. I love to hear him talk because he always has fun stories to tell. And he said that the children come to him. Of course, they all have problems. He doesn't see the others. And he always has them draw a picture of either the mother or the father, whoever he feels has set this problem off. And this child came in one day and he asked him to draw a picture of his mother. And he did. And he faced her to the wall. And he says, why did you face her to the wall? If I turned her around, it would have been yakety, yakety, yak. You know, I think one thing we must do is try not to say no unless we really mean no. Don't say anything until you're sure. And if there's any possibility of saying yes, say yes. They want their autonomy. This is what they're striving for. And the more autonomy we can give them legitimately, the less they'll try to take, you know, illegitimately. But if we can just help them, give them enough leeway to make their decisions and to make them feel that they're their own person, then they won't start this power play that's so devastating. And I think if you would read Dreiker's, you'd get a lot of practical help from him. No, Dreiker. I sent my Dreikers to my daughter. She has twins. She has twins who are 5.5, and she needed it when they were about 3.5.
One thing that
What's
I found that helps me.
The Children, the Challenge is Children, the Challenge is the name of that by Dreikers. What were you?
One thing that I found helps me with my child who's 5.5 and constantly saying mama, 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 say in the afternoon. you have a quiet hour in your room, and he has to stay in his room, but he can do anything he wants to in his room, and can't come and say, Mama, Mama, Mama.
Mm-hmm.
He has to learn to live with himself
mm-hmm.
as his little person, and to realize that he can entertain himself, and he can, as you say, be autonomous. With,
yeah.
I set up a boundary. He can't come out of his room except to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
No, he but he can't come and bother me.
Yeah.
He can't come see me.
You know, a timer helps here, too.
Yes,
I started doing that. Just
yeah,
like
just
weeks.
So they know you aren't going to tell them when the hour is up, but the timer will tell them, more mechanical. You know, then they can't blame you. You know,
it also keeps them from saying how much
longer.
Yeah,
they can look on there, and if they can see that, if they can read numbers yet, at least they can tell how far the thing has to go. This is good. I like this exchange, because you people have a children of similar ages, and you can help each other so much with practical ideas. I know Dreiker says to keep out of the power play there sometimes when you have to go lock yourself in the bathroom.
You
pardon me?
I don't know whether it's in paperback or yet or not. It was hardback when I got it. Now, don't take Dreiker's hook, line, and sinker. There are some things about what he says that I don't approve of. Sometimes I feel that he manipulates the child too much, and I don't like this. But there are some really superb devices that he uses that I think are perfectly legitimate.
I find being consistent the most
difficult. Oh, it's difficult.
I mean, that's even an unnecessary statement. Somehow, if I could get that,
right. Then
yeah.
they know.
Yeah.
Then the boundary
sure.
stays where it's set.
And then, too, to get, you know, my husband and I, too.
Right. Right.
That adds one more factor.
Right.
And, he would prefer to be much more strict than I am.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm there all day, and that's what I keep saying to him. And I would prefer to say yes as much as I can. Like you say, maybe it's because I'm lazy or weak, I don't know what, but I run into less trouble if I can say yes more often than
right.
I have to be constantly saying no.
Right.
But he comes from a family of three boys where the father is quite strict and feels he should be strict, but we have three little girls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I'd like to sometime have a session just for fathers, because I'm going on Friday. I can't do it. But really, there is such a special place that they can play in the lives of their children that it can be so delightful. I know we have three girls, too, and I just feel that their father has been such a tremendous positive influence upon them, because he has treated them like girls. And he has bragged about them, you know. Praise from Dad is just 10 times better than praise from Mama.
Mm-hmm.
And as they learn to do things, he'd always notice. You know, when they made a dress as they got older, he would tell them how nice they looked. And he was much quicker at seeing the good in them than I, because I was with them all the time. He traveled. He was home only 50% of the time. He was an oil geologist, and later became an executive and had to be traveling to the main office all the time. And that we kept track of the days, and he was gone more than he was home. But this was not devastating to them, because the time he spent with them was, he appreciated them so much more. They appreciated him. And they really have a solid relationship now. They all have families of their own, and he's terribly special to them. And I think it was just because he was always accentuating the positive. And, of course, I think there's a very special relationship between daddies and their daughters anyway. That they're really missing something very precious if they don't establish it early.
You know what you said about when they're playing, they're practicing life. I appreciate that. I wish you'd tell it to Don. He sees Leonard here. All that kid ever does is play. He never does anything else but play.
Tell him to come to my conceptual learning thing tomorrow, the Piaget's, and I'll describe in detail some of the play and just exactly how the mind is growing. And
well, you can see it. He mm-hmm. sees him play, but I'm around him all day and I watch him, and it's amazing.
He figures things out.
You can almost see those wheels.
Of course,
it's beautiful.
Right. Any other comments?
How about the book Parent Effectiveness Training?
Oh, I think PET is just great. I took the course myself just about 2 years ago in order to know what the parents were learning in this course and how to evaluate it. And I think it's delightful because it does some of the things that I mentioned in my first little talk, that the fact that you need to help the child understand his own feelings, but at the same time you want to convey your feelings too, instead of just exploding at them and it looks like there's just no reason at all. Say, now when you do this, it makes me feel this way and I just won't put up with it, you know. Let them know that you have feelings too.
That sounds like Genoa.
Yeah, yeah. Genoa.
Oh, mm-hmm. I thought with French he'd have to be Genoa.
Well, he has it pronounced Genoa on television.
All right.
That's all I know. But
good, that's easier.
Yeah.
I heard he could be Genoa.